Major funding for The Pulse is provided by a leadership gift from the Sutherland Family Charitable Fund. The Sutherlands support WHYY and its commitment to the production of programs that improve our quality of life.
Math is everywhere, and all kinds of things you'd like to do, actually, you can use math to do it.
That's what math teachers will tell you, and usually it's met with eye rolls. I'm Mike and Scott, and this is The Pulse, stories at the heart of health, science, and innovation.
You measure a sample, but you measure millions and billions of molecules all at the same time.
You get to see these patients over and over again. They become part of your family.
It's a virus that likes to attack lots of different organ systems.
You know, everything falls apart.
How about a bag of frozen peas to keep you comfy? Plus,
bingo.
So here's this population that never gets studied.
Pretty much all of cell biology
there
needs to kind of be redone.
For
I first opened the little box
before
and there was a cell.
All of the surgeries selection that have prior
yet. We're just getting some of the medicine through your IV.
Basically, we wanted to know if there was any point to doing it.
What was your defiant teenager line when you were in high school and you didn't want to study? When will I ever need this? That's what I always said, and somehow that seemed especially true for science subjects, which is kind of tragic. How can something as fascinating as science turn into something so incredibly dull in an educational setting? Our show today is about the intersection of science and education, making science education more exciting, using science to help people study better, and getting scientists to use simple language. We're going to start with math.
Out. You get the big triangle? We gotta connect them.
I recently went to an event where kids were building a Sierpinski triangle. It's a structure used in geometry. Basically, it's a triangle made of triangles, made of triangles, and the kids were having a lot of fun. They were assembling these triangles of all sizes from thousands of Kinex pieces. That's basically a nerdy version of Legos. And the math professor leading this effort, Victor Donet, he said he wanted to get kids excited about math.
I believe that everybody starts out loving math because math is about patterns and shapes. But unfortunately, with so much standardized testing in our educational system today, there's a focus not on the beauty and the excitement of mathematics so much, but more on the technical skills.
Donet told me that he's really worried that not enough kids leave schools with the math skills to get into science or tech. And I've heard this from a lot of people. Less than half of students who start college thinking they'll pursue a STEM field end up doing it. And often it's math holding them back. Some college math departments are deciding they want to change the way they teach this tough subject. Karen Shikurji reports.
It's about 11 a.m. on a warm winter day at San Diego State University, and I walked into a classroom where a couple dozen students in t-shirts and shorts are hanging out before pre-calculus begins. The room has no windows, it's tan and fluorescent, but the kids, they're energetic.
Anybody else need a penny? Everybody got a penny? If you need a penny, raise your hand. I got some up here.
Bob, a recent graduate, is running things today, goading students into thinking about the question at hand. At what rate might an infectious disease spread?
All right, so get up and meet new people. Introduce yourself, shake hands.
10 different people, please. 10 different
students people. Pair up and they each flip a penny.
Remind me of your name?
Jorge.
J-O-R-G-E.
Okay.
And then I'm Lauren.
Tails means you get the disease, heads means you're in the clear. They do this data collection for 10 rounds, noting down heads or tails each time.
I don't know why I've gotten all tails. I mean, I don't know if it's probably a coincidence, but it's just weird.
They sit down, and now it's time to understand what it all means.
So, Julia, what did he give you?
He got tails.
He gave you tails?
Yeah.
Man, people are just dying. It's like the plague.
And when the fun ends and the projector screen comes down and Bob starts saying things like Y is 1 when C and A and X is 0, despite the change from fun class activity to a discussion about data points, it looks like the students are still engaged. They're watching Bob graph results onto a chart using exponential functions.
So using these points, we can substitute. What any base to a power of 0, what's that?
So this isn't exactly the way a lot of us might remember college math.
It's very different. I've heard that they're trying to make a lot of changes, and to some extent, we're definitely like guinea pigs.
This is Julia Maria Escobedo, a pre-med biology major.
And we don't do multiple choice. It's actually all free response. So that was really different for us. But yeah, I'd rather change happen now than never, you know?
San Diego State has revamped their math program this year because D, F, and withdrawal rates got as high as 35% to 50%. And as a powerful report from the President's Council of Advisors on Science and Technology, or PCAST, pointed out 4 years ago, failing math grades don't just mean low GPAs. Mathematics is a core component of careers in engineering, technology, and science. So failing leaves kids who want to go into a STEM field in a difficult spot. Also in that same report, less than 40% of students who plan to pursue a STEM major actually do it.
Yeah, it's quite a number. And there's going to be the need for a million more STEM graduates in the next decade than we're currently producing.
This is Chris Rasmussen, professor of mathematics education at San Diego State. He researches how students learn and teaches math to future math teachers.
So I think people started looking at their courses and saying, we can probably do better.
In 2010, Rasmussen did a survey asking math departments nationwide about how and why they teach math. And he came up with something like a recipe for how to teach calculus. One of those ingredients, active learning.
So what I mean by that, there's deep engagement in mathematics by students, and there's lots of peer-to-peer interaction. So classrooms in which students are building up ideas for themselves rather than passively sitting back and listening to someone else do the thinking for them.
In education, questions about how we learn best and teach best and test best are all hot buttons. K-12 schools have been grappling with Common Core guidelines in the 40-plus states that have adopted it. Common Core is a pretty complicated set of guidelines, but the philosophy of it all is basically what Rasmussen is talking about, active learning.
If you look at the math practices in the Common Core, a number of those practices are about doing mathematics in rigorous, authentic ways.
But colleges and K-12 schools aren't following each other. It's more like two different animals who seem to be hunting for the same thing. And some say it's not a coincidence. In a recent report from the Mathematical Association of America, authors reference a powerful 2014 study right at the top. Researchers analyzed 225 studies to answer one question. Is active learning actually better? They compared failure rates from undergrad STEM lecture and active learning courses and found that, on average, 66% of students pass in lectures and almost 80% pass with active learning.
This results in much better student success and also benefits those students, underrepresented minority students and women's students. So it begins to close some of the gender gap and other gaps that are present.
That 12% difference might seem small, but it's kind of huge. Hundreds of thousands of students take intro STEM courses each year, 300,000 in the U.S. for intro biology majors alone. So a 12% increase means that tens of thousands more students could continue in STEM with active learning. But some experts caution against thinking of any one particular teaching method being the method for student success. James Milgram, professor of mathematics emeritus at Stanford University, says that especially for advanced math, discovery-based learning is inefficient because complex problems take a lot of time.
What these courses represent are thousands of years of development by very, very bright people. You cannot effectively get to that level with having kids try to reproduce for themselves thousands of years of development.
For schools like San Diego State, with 30,000 students, making all classes small and discussion-based isn't really an option. There are only so many professors to go around. If you have one professor teaching 150 students versus 30 at a time, it saves a lot of money. So at SDSU, TAs or even undergrads teach the active sessions, and students take a combination of both, active sessions and lecture.
Okay. What about negative one? If I plug in negative one, what do I get?
In a large classroom at SDSU, a graduate teaching assistant is standing at the front going over problems on a whiteboard. The graphs and charts look like a drawing of a complicated highway system. From my vantage point at the back of the classroom, several students seem tuned out, tweeting or texting or Snapchatting. But one student, in a red top and matching red Converse, sitting right in front of the teacher, is following along closely. After class, she tells me it's not exactly her first time taking pre-calc.
My name is Chelsea Castillo-Adame. I am a fourth-year student at SDSU as a pre-med major.
Chelsea always knew that she wanted to be a doctor. At 18 years old, she enlisted in the Navy Medical Corps. When she left 5 years later, she knew the transition back to civilian life was going to be tough, but she wasn't prepared to feel so unprepared for, of all things, math class.
Halfway through that class, I was failing everything.
That class was pre-calculus at the University of Nevada, Las Vegas. She was getting D's, and she says she was doing better than most of her classmates.
I would leave classes and exams literally in tears. Like, I went to the bathroom and I cried after my math exam, almost every math exam. And it was very humbling to go into the professor and say, look, this is me. I am so frustrated. I'm bawling my eyes out and I know this material.
Now, Chelsea is an overachiever for sure, her words, not mine, but those tears weren't just about getting D's. She needed to pass pre-calc so she could take chemistry, a pre-med requirement. With only so much scholarship money, she considered her options, stay and retake pre-calc in the same way or go elsewhere in hopes of doing better. Now at SDSU, she says things are different.
It's not a matter of, okay, put this number into a calculator and get that answer. Anybody can do that, but can you understand what's happening within the math?
Rasmussen, the math education professor at San Diego State, is analyzing data from another recent nationwide survey, in part to figure out how many schools are doing what.
44% of all the respondents said that active learning is very important for student success in the pre-calculus to calculus 2 courses. That's an amazing number to me.
Because 10 years ago, he says, 44% of math departments wouldn't have said active learning is very important, but only 17% of departments say they're successful at it.
So there's an awareness of the need to do something more reasonable for students, but also an awareness like, we're not really sure how to do this yet.
As for Chelsea, she's loving math again. Next semester, she's going to start tutoring.
Once you get it, it's completely fun to me. And if I'm able to teach it in a way that maybe other students can help and that I understand it, then that helps me learn as well, too.
For The Pulse, I'm Karen Chakurji.
This piece was produced in partnership with the Hechinger Report. We asked you to tell us about your experiences with learning math, and some listeners sent us recordings they taped on their smartphones. Let's take a listen.
My name is Joseph DiOrio, and I'm in Nashville, Tennessee. I'm a writer, which means I am oriented toward words. It means I avoid math at every turn. It means I have nightmares about my high school Algebra 2 class and the teacher, Mr. Spencer. But just recently, I was talking to a colleague about a quota, and I quickly calculated our remaining target and our positive odds of meeting said target. Oh, wow, she said. You did that really fast. Thanks, Mr. Spencer, wherever you are.
And Pulse contributor Bethany Brookshire, a former scientist, now science writer, sent us this recollection.
I hated math for most of my life. In college, I had to take math to stay in science, and those calculus classes were hideous. People told me it was okay, I just wasn't good at math. But my junior year of college, I began taking classes toward a philosophy major, and I decided to go into logic. It came easy to me, and I loved it. One day, I was working out a part of my thesis with my advisor, and he looked up at me and said, "You're really good at this. You must be really good at math." I was floored. No, I'm terrible at math. Everyone says so. But his comment stayed with me. If I could do symbolic logic, I could calculate molar concentrations. I could do statistics. Math is still a challenge for me, but now it's a challenge that I like.
Thank you, Bethany and Joe, and to all of you who've shared memories with us. If you want to talk more, just leave a comment on our Facebook page. We're talking about science and education on today's edition of The Pulse. And we've all experienced death by PowerPoint at a conference before, right? Somebody is up on stage going wah, 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 and everybody in the audience has completely tuned out and is just staring at their smartphones. Could a dose of humor shake things up?
An infectious disease walks into a bar. The bartender says, "We don't serve infectious diseases in this bar." The infectious disease says, "Well, you're not a very good host."
That's Brian Mallow. He is a science comedian. He tells jokes about the speed of light, and he actually gets the math right. And he joins us now to talk more about his work, how he comes up with his material. How did you get started with science humor?
You know, I was into science way before I thought about becoming a a comedian. I considered becoming a scientist, but I didn't. So when I became a comedian in Austin, Texas, because of a funniest person in Austin contest, right from the beginning, my love of science and geekiness informed my act.
And where do you get your material from? Do you read the science journals? Do you go online and go to all the great science websites?
Well, yes. Not the actual journal articles, but the science news that's for lay people. So I fill my head with this stuff. I'm not always sitting there reading it and looking for jokes immediately. Sometimes you throw it in the hopper and who knows when it may be useful. I haven't always been a comic. I used to be an astronomer, but I got stuck on the day shift, which sucks. You don't discover anything good. Whoa, a cloud. Great.
Brian, in addition to your comedy act, you also talk at science conferences and you give presentations for scientists. What do you want them to learn?
The presentations that I give are mostly geared towards helping scientists be better presenters on stage. One of the key things is to remember that it's really only communication if you connect with someone. If you're just up there spouting the things you want to say without taking into account the listener, you're not going to communicate as well. The best communicators are very aware of the listener, who they are, what they know, and they pay attention to cues. Like you see if someone understands what you're saying. So someone will walk up to you, a scientist, and hand you a thumb drive and go, here's my presentation. And I think that that's wrong right there. I think that you shouldn't think of your slides as your presentation. You are the presentation.
Let's listen to another clip from one of your performances.
Two bacteria walk into a bar. The bartender says, we don't serve bacteria in this bar. The bacteria say, but we work here. We're staff. Good. A groan and an applause. Somehow I think that's the perfect response.
Brian, most comedians experience hecklers and being heckled. Is the heckling smarter when the crowd is more scientifically minded?
Now, I do get some of the weirdest heckles because if you call yourself a science comedian, then there's this expectation that when you say things, they're at least going to be scientifically accurate, which is not really a restriction on most other comedians. They can say the stupidest, most absurd, flawed things, and it doesn't really matter. But for me, people will jump on it. So yeah, I get strange. I had this thing where I was talking about the heat in Arizona. I was in Tucson in the summer and it was 110. And I mentioned that it was 125 in Lake Havasu. And that just sounds like science fiction. And I said, you're talking about the surface of Venus. And someone from the back of the room yelled out, no, Venus is much hotter than that. And you know what? You know, I actually knew that. I was using a comedic device called exaggeration, and I should be able to. So that is a weird – I can get a weird kind of heckle where someone wants to correct my science or argue about it. Yeah. I can see them looking sometimes. I see they've lost the thread of the joke because they're focused on the math. Sometimes I say all of these jokes are peer-reviewed.
Brian, thank you so much for joining us.
Thanks for having me.
Brian Mallow is a science comedian. This is The Pulse. I'm Mike and Scott, and you can find our podcast on iTunes. Today, we're talking about the intersection of science and education, and our next story is about research that's informing what a lot of kids really need in school. They need help coping with the emotional fallout from their lives. Research is learning a lot about the effect of something called toxic stress on learning. Toxic stress is a byproduct of living with constant adversity, poverty, violence, abuse, neglect. And in many big cities with very high rates of children living in these kinds of environments, the path to academic success can be especially steep. Reporter Kevin McCrory takes us inside a Philadelphia public school where educators are trying to implement new approaches against overwhelming odds.
School counselor Pam Turner Bunyan had been warned. This new incoming student was prone to very erratic behavior.
When he first came to us, he ran out of the building. The first day, very first day, instead of coming in, he ran.
She immediately took off, dashing out into the crime-prone streets that surround the school.
I found out that he was running, so I went and chased him down and coaxed him back in.
Turner Bunyan has 15 years under her belt as counselor at Feltonville Intermediate, a Philadelphia public school serving grades 3, 4, and 5, where most students come from low-income families. Years ago, in the same situation, she would have reacted differently, maybe gotten angry, and tried to lecture the student sternly about his misbehavior. But that was before she learned about trauma-informed care.
It's saying, what can we do to intentionally work with children and minimize the stress so that then children are able to think and function in school? And not saying, oh, you're just an angry kid, you know, you need to do X, Y, and Z. But saying, you're angry, and I want to understand why, because I value you.
For Turner Bunyan, it's about empathy and finding strategies that work for each student.
And so for him, it was trying to figure out a safe spot that he could go to, that he could feel alone, and that he could escape. And one of the things that we found out really quickly, he and I did, was that he really likes to read.
But what works for one child doesn't for another. She has many students who live the depths of poverty. Kids who've recently had close family members who've suffered sudden, violent deaths. Others who've been the ones to find the bodies of relatives who've committed suicide. Like the student who sought refuge in running, many of these students struggle to focus in the classroom, and their stressors can manifest in often unruly ways.
A kid will be throwing a desk and throwing a chair, and I will have to go up and get them. It's real, real crisis stuff.
But over time, Turner Bunyan has learned how to quickly de-escalate these situations, often by engaging students' senses.
I have students that come in that, for example, need hugs in the morning. So I give them hugs, you know, and you can see that that totally, just that hug changes their ability to be able to function.
For others, the answer can be plastic.
I keep stock of empty water bottles, and I have them see, we play games to make them as small as you possibly can. And the kids will squeeze, and the sound and the physically breaking it apart helps to calm kids down.
Turner Bunyan learned about many of these practices through training provided by the school district. Training that's guided by the work of one of the top researchers in the field, Drexel University's Sandra Bloom.
The same areas of the brain that we need for performing academically are the parts of the brain often that are most negatively impacted by toxic stress.
Bloom has been on the forefront of scholarship that delves into the effects of what are known as adverse childhood experiences, which can literally change the way the brain is wired.
Now, because of research that's been done, we understand that exposure to all different kinds of adversity in childhood can produce lots of health, mental health, and social problems in adulthood. And that may seem kind of obvious, but we haven't, until quite recently, had the science to back it up.
The Adverse Childhood Experiences, or ACEs, study was first performed in San Diego in 1998. It found a staggering correlation between the extent of experiences like abuse and neglect in childhood and rates of early death, substance abuse, and other crippling ailments later on. Overcoming the effects of trauma, which are often amplified and exacerbated by poverty, is no small feat, But Bloom says schools should be primed to take on this responsibility.
But to do that, we have to understand that education needs to be more than reading, writing, and arithmetic, that we really need to help kids develop socially and emotionally as well if we want them to have good academic performance.
But that will take rethinking the way we see misbehavior in school. Kids who live in a relentlessly stressful condition can become trapped in a state of fight or flight. That blocks cognitive ability and gives kids a hair trigger response system. So seemingly little things can blow up into disruptive incidents. But when teachers and counselors take the time to ease student stress, Bloom says over time it can be a major boon to overall health.
And those can then become basically therapeutic experiences for those kids.
But to really scale up that method will take a gigantic commitment to the importance of the issue and the resources to back it up. A very challenging prospect for a perpetually cash-strapped school district like Philadelphia or Baltimore or Los Angeles. At Feltonville Intermediate, school counselor Turner Bunyan knows those challenges all too well.
Oh, that's a definite big thing, you know, because I'm the only counselor here for 700 plus students.
She's been trying to implement these theories in the midst of dealing with other fires and limited support.
There's no roadmap here. We're kind of creating our own as we go along.
Just 2 miles away from Turner Bunyan's daily struggles, a school in another poverty-stricken neighborhood is facing much better odds at taking trauma-informed care to new levels.
So today we're going to talk about that student that was brought up last week when we were identifying students that we're concerned about.
Rachel Hodes is the school psychologist at Cristo Rey, a private school for low-income students that opened 4 years ago, built from the ground up with trauma-informed care in mind.
We're fortunate that because we started it this way, that we've really set that precedence, that this is where we're going to focus.
Compared to the district schools, Cristo Rey is stacked with support staff. It has 3 full-time counselors and 3 other counseling interns for 450 students, and there's a whole other department that focuses on higher education placement. At Cristo Rey, faculty also get 1 full day a week to collaborate and strategize about how to meet the specific needs of individual students, like in this made-up training scenario.
She just started coming in later, so she would miss days, and then she would miss assignments and miss notes, and then
she did
from
say,
then on her grades started.
You know, you can share that something's going on at home that's affecting her at school.
But to implement this sort of approach in every public school would require a major new investment in counseling staff and teacher training. As costly as that would be, Sandra Bloom believes it would be well worth the investment.
To be crass, we're going to get our biggest bang for our buck. Right now, we might as well just put our national wealth on a bonfire and just set it alight, because we're wasting all this money later on health care and mental health care and social services and suffering that doesn't have an economic figure attached, that really we wouldn't have to if we just take care of kids.
Until that happens, Bloom says many students, especially those at under-resourced schools like Feltonville, are being set up for failure. For The Pulse, I'm Kevin McCrory.
You're listening to The Pulse. I'm Mike and Scott. Our next story is also about mental health, but in a college setting. Helping students who are struggling with issues like anxiety or depression is important for their academic success, and college counseling centers have done more and more outreach to make sure students feel comfortable asking for help. And apparently, they've been very successful, so much so that demand has skyrocketed and many counseling centers now struggle to keep up. Renee Gross reports from Ann Arbor, Michigan.
Outside of the University of Michigan's Counseling and Psychological Center, known as CAPS for short, there's a wall filled with student messages written on small wooden blocks.
One says, you are cherished and beloved. One says, you matter and you are loved. Good times and bad, they all pass. One is written in a different language than English, but then English translation says, don't give up.
Dr. Todd Sevig is the director of the Michigan CAPS program. He says inviting students to write comforting messages is just one of the center's many outreach projects.
Our job is to really help individual students, but we also try to help the culture, the community, the campus.
But creating a culture more accepting of mental health issues has had some unexpected consequences. It means that more students are feeling comfortable asking for help. Dr. Sevig says this is a wonderful thing, but the increase has also presented some challenges.
Just this fall semester, we had an increase of 20% in terms of students coming in requesting services. There was one week compared to the same week the year before that the increase was 45%.
It was rough, to be honest.
That's Dr. Christine C. Dow. She's the Director of Engagement and Community Outreach at the U of M CAPS Counseling Center.
We have a large staff, but if you think about our student population, for around 53 people, it's not necessarily enough sometimes for 43,000 students, right?
The entire staff had to think creatively to try to address the students' needs. So they hired temporary staff, increased the number of groups available, and did more workshops on preventative coping skills.
So we tried many, many different things, but again, those numbers were kind of staggering. So,
University of Michigan isn't alone. Colleges across the country are experiencing a similar boom in demand for mental health services. And again, this is a good thing.
In some ways, we've made some headway that more students are prepared to reach out for help sooner because I think as a system, we've been doing a good job educating young people.
That's Dr. Victor Schwartz. He's a psychiatric professor at NYU and the medical director of the Jed Foundation, which helps promote mental health on college campuses. Schwartz says education and outreach isn't the only reason behind the swell of traffic at counseling centers.
There are some number of young people who in the past might not have been able to make it to college and, you know, other higher ed settings who now are able to attend, but, you know, they come with their medical and mental health histories.
Another change is that students are seeking help at the college counseling centers instead of in their communities. Why? Money. In the community, the cost of treatment depends on what your insurance covers. But on campus, mental health services are included in the cost of tuition. Now, college counseling centers are trying to expand to offer more services to more people. But first, they have to go through the backlog of students already signed up for help.
If you follow college newspapers, you'll certainly regularly see articles that are decrying a 2 or 3 week wait to be seen at the counseling service.
It can take a while to get an appointment.
Taylor Baranski decided to visit the CAPS Counseling Center her freshman year at U of M. At the time, she was struggling with depression and self-mutilation. These difficulties made it hard to wait even just a week.
You know, just self-hatred, frustration. When you're going through these things, a week is a long time.
Back at the University of Michigan's CAPS Counseling Center, Dr. Sevig says he's working on this issue. And he notes that the center now has a crisis counselor on duty for students who need to be seen immediately. He's also in the process of addressing the other concerns brought about by the increase of student demand. But he doesn't want the outreach to stop. In fact, he wants to build on it. He wants to reach groups where mental health stigma still hasn't gone down.
More students are engaged in mental health this year, the last 2 years, than ever before. And so we are both promoting, helping, supporting that, but also trying to extend that. How can we use that wave for the greater good here?
Dr. Sevig is working with his staff to put his money where his vision is. This spring, large signs advertising the College Counseling Center will appear inside all of the university buses. Despite strained resources, he says he hopes this campaign will be taking one more step towards creating a healthier campus culture for all. For The Pulse, I'm Renee Gross.
Birds will gather at my side. Tears will gather in my eyes.
This is The Pulse. I'm Mike and Scott. Today we're talking about science and education. A lot of scientists are doing a difficult balancing act right now. They are just beginning to understand the Zika virus while also educating all of us about the dangers without causing widespread panic.
Well, that's really a big challenge. And I think what is happening is there's so much media coverage of Zika that if people don't read the articles carefully, they may get the impression that Zika is a huge threat to everyone, and that's not true at all. It's really only a threat to pregnant women.
Pregnant women, because the virus can cause microcephaly in babies. That was Scott Weaver talking just now. He is a virologist at the University of Texas Medical Branch who has been studying Zika for a long time, long before it became a big issue. The virus is spread mostly by mosquitoes called Aedes aegypti, biting people who have the virus, then getting infected themselves, and then passing the virus to another person with their next bite. I talked to Scott Weaver right after he returned from a big Zika conference in Atlanta this week, and I asked him, what was the mood like?
People are very worried. There were a lot of Brazilian scientists there. Of course, Brazil has been the hardest hit so far with Zika virus. Thousands of cases of fetal microcephaly. I think, unfortunately, you know, our options for controlling this outbreak are very limited in Brazil right now. I don't think anyone's very optimistic that mosquito control is going to be the solution to controlling this outbreak. And then in the United States, we're having lots of imported cases now. So we especially need to educate pregnant women to, if all possible, postpone travel to the affected areas of Latin America and the Caribbean. And then people who do need to travel or choose to travel, and this applies to anyone in any age group, there's a possibility that they'll be infected while they're in Latin America or the Caribbean, and they'll return infected by the virus. And we're seeing over 300 of those have been detected so far. Probably many more have gone undetected because most of these infections are asymptomatic.
Mosquitoes in this country could also spread this virus, right?
Absolutely. Our history with dengue and chikungunya the past decade or so tells us that these imported cases can initiate local transmission. It's happened in Florida, Texas, Arizona. What I don't think we need to be concerned about is millions of people getting Zika virus infection here, because we simply don't have the same degree of contact with mosquitoes thanks to our air conditioners and screening our windows and so forth in the U.S.
What are the symptoms?
4 out of 5 people roughly don't develop any symptoms at all, but a typical symptomatic infection includes fever, a rash, conjunctivitis, which turns the eyes red, some pain in the joints, and these are very nonspecific flu-like symptoms that can be confused with many other infections. So the only thing that really distinguishes people in the U.S. right now is the travel history that suggests it might be Zika.
And Scott, once you've been infected with the virus, symptoms or no symptoms, how long does it stay in your body?
Well, we think that usually it's gone by about 2 weeks. There are two exceptions to that, and one is that when men become infected, the presence of the viral genetic material has been detected in semen more than 2 months later. We don't know if that virus is still capable of infecting a male or a female partner at that point sexually. And then pregnant women who develop fetal infections appear to have a prolonged viremia or virus in their bloodstream that can last for many weeks or even a few months.
And as far as viruses go, is this an especially strange one or fairly typical?
Well, it is strange in many ways, and it's really caught a lot of us by surprise. So this is the only mosquito-borne virus that we have learned can be sexually transmitted. And then the microcephaly, the fetal infection with these bad outcomes where the brain doesn't develop normally, this is, again, the first human mosquito-borne virus known to cause this.
Now, as researchers are working on this virus at an accelerated pace, what do you hope to see in the near future?
Well, I think that we're already seeing some of the initial vaccine candidates getting ready for testing in animals. We call that preclinical testing. In fact, here on our campus, we have a few commercial partners who are coming to us wanting us to test their vaccines in the first mouse models that we developed here. I think the NIH is saying that they're hoping to start a clinical trial of the first vaccines later this year, and I think that that's probably a realistic time frame. But on the other hand, getting a vaccine the whole way through the regulatory process to being licensed for general use is probably going to take a few years.
Scott Weaver is a virologist at the University of Texas, and he studies the Zika virus. You're listening to The Pulse. I'm Mike and Scott, and our show this week is about science and education, and it's also Teacher Appreciation Week. So we asked our listeners, hey, tell us about teachers who have had a huge influence on you. Here's one recording we got.
My name is Deshika Narayanan. I'm an assistant professor of astronomy and physics at Haverford College. Back in the early 2000s, when I was a PhD student in astronomy, I was doing a lot of computer coding, and I spent an entire summer searching for one bug in my computer program, and it was driving me absolutely crazy. I felt like I was spinning my wheels all summer, constantly bringing plots to my advisor, and feeling like I was making absolutely no progress, which, of course, since I was an early grad student, made me doubt my prospects in a career in astronomy. And during one particularly downtime, my advisor said to me, he said, you know, Deshika, if people got it right the first time, they would call it search and not research. So you're doing the right thing. And that little quote gave me confidence that other people also struggled in math and physics and astronomy, and that I was going down the right path. And eventually I did find the bug.
Thank you for sharing that. And sometimes an important teacher is not a trained educator. Here's a memory shared by paleontologist Ken Lacovera.
When I was in second grade, a woman brought a box of rocks and minerals and fossils into my Cub Scout meeting. And I had really never seen anything like this. And it blew my mind. And I went home the next day and I wrote an essay. And I wrote that sedimentary rocks were the best because you could find fossils in them. So that one random act of kindness by a woman whose name I don't know really changed the course of my life, and I'm incredibly grateful for it today.
Ken Lacovera went on to discover one of the biggest dinosaurs ever, the Dreadnoughtus, so those rocks and that Cub Scout meeting really paid off. But not everybody is that lucky to have one person to just walk in and inspire them. So how do you get kids interested in the sciences? Some people think that if scientists were better at talking about what it is they actually do, making it digestible for kids, that would help. Tanya English spoke with some scientists who are trying to learn to be better communicators, and she started at the University of Pennsylvania.
Have you guys learned about the different parts of the brain at all?
We're at a science carnival, and college students are stationed all around the room like competing barkers, enticing little kids to step right up for a chance to smell something, smash something, or get their hands dirty.
Yeah, sheep.
Oh, a sheep.
So this is a sheep brain. Do one of you want to try to cut the brain directly in half? Here, you can do it first, and then you can do a second cut after.
Four girls from Cornerstone Christian Academy in Philadelphia are a swirl of pleated skirts, hair ribbons, and a pink backpack. They have on rubber gloves, they have a scalpel, and they're just waiting for their turn to slice into a sheep's brain or blow something up.
My name is Miranda, and like when we screamed, stuff like exploded everywhere.
This fair is supposed to make the scientists better communicators and make the students love science. These girls don't need convincing, but ask about Bill Nye the Science Guy, and they're not impressed.
Have you seen him?
Yeah.
Think he's cool or not so cool?
Not so cool.
Cachet, Miranda, and Kennedy can't name one scientist that they love.
I don't really know people that do science. I just like it.
So who do you like on TV that does science? Do you know anyone that does science? Adults?
No.
Do you know any women who do science?
No.
If you want them to pay attention to molecular fusion or engineering, the girls suggest that you get Beyonce, or one of their favorite teen actors from the Disney Channel,
Sky Jackson, Pedalis,
to talk with them about science. One experiment is set up like an air hockey game. kids are shuttling balls back and forth to show how nerve cells in their brain communicate. Behind the table is college senior Sheila Shankar. She's a double major and a member of the Honor Society. You couldn't ask for a better science role model. But when she starts her spiel, I'm lost.
So we have one side here, which act as the vesicles, which release neurotransmitters.
What are vesicles?
Vesicles are like little bubbles that release neurotransmitters, or the chemicals.
What are neurotransmitters?
Neuroscience is almost like Shankar's native language, but I speak plain English, so I ask her to start over.
So say that you're one cell phone, and you want to communicate with your friend who has another cell phone. You would send your friend a text message, which is like a neuron sending neurotransmitters to another neuron.
And the second time around, she's ready with an answer that both the kids and I understand. Every year, there's a contest in New York that gives adults a chance to practice talking that way with children. Stony Brook University challenges scientists to explain a simple concept in a way that engages an 11-year-old.
The fuel loses mass, it turns to a gas before the next changes through.
The first winner was a guy studying quantum optics who submitted this song.
Pyrolysis, chemiluminescence.
You cannot put that on the interview, though.
Christine O'Connell is Associate Director of the Alan Alda Center for Communicating Science. She says it's 4 years later, and she still remembers that song and all the science concepts that it explains. O'Connell says contest founder Alan Alda was fascinated by fire when he was a boy, and he asked his teacher, what is a flame?
Her answer to him was oxidation, and that just didn't satisfy his curiosity at all. It made him more confused.
Some scientists get tangled up in academic speak. Good explainers say just enough and leave young students a little bit curious. Stony Brook teaches workshops on how to do that.
A lot of what we do is based in improvisation and teaching scientists improvisation games and techniques, which is all about connecting to the person you're talking to, getting out of your own head, putting the focus on them.
Past contestants have had success with animated videos and fancy editing, but sometimes the winner is the scientist who simply stands in front of a camera and uses the most vivid words. O'Connell says every year, kids from around the world give the scientist constructive criticism.
It's okay to be funny, but it's not okay to be silly. You know, we're 11, we're not 7.
This year, the contest question is, what is sound?
Thank you very much. Let's go to Illinois. Come on up to the mic at the Roosevelt Middle School. What did you think of that video?
Well, I thought it was the best entry that there was because it used hands-on experiments. And it made me wonder about other things, about how my instrument, which is the tuba, made sound, even though it didn't have strings.
About 23,000 11-year-olds are reviewing the videos from three finalists. That includes a submission from college physics teacher Nick Wexer.
All sound starts as a vibration. Something has to wiggle. Seriously, touch right here on your neck and say, come on.
Keeping it interactive is always a good idea.
Wexer says he's an introvert, but when he puts on his YouTube persona and calls himself Nick Lucid, he's different. In his explainer video, Nick Lucid shrinks down
Super Zoom
to take the kids on a deep dive tour of the inner ear. He never gets lost in jargon.
Instead of jumping right in and talking about, you know, waves and using words like frequency, I had to start talking about, you know, things, you know, vibrating or wiggling.
And that might be the best advice for aspiring science communicators. There's power in words like wiggle.
So sound starts out as a wiggle in something solid, and then becomes a wiggle in the air, and then a wiggle in your ear, and finally a perception in your brain. It's a perception of a vibration. I hope that made sense to some of you. And until next time, remember, it's okay to be a little crazy.
That was Tanya English reporting. She's one of our health and science reporters for The Pulse, which comes to you from WHYY in Philadelphia. Our other reporters are Alana Gordon and Todd Bookman. Charlie Kyer is our engineer, Paige Flager, the associate producer, Joel Patterson, our managing editor, and Megan Pinto, our executive producer. I'm Mike and Scott. Thank you for listening.
Independence Blue Cross supports WHYY's The Pulse. Independence is coming to your neighborhood to help you understand healthcare options. Licensed agents can help prepare you for whatever may be ahead. Learn more at ibx.com/events. Independence Blue Cross. Live fearless. Ben Franklin Technology Partners of Southeastern Pennsylvania supports WHYY's The Pulse and are partners with a purpose, providing capital, counsel, and connections to technology entrepreneurs and investors in the greater Philadelphia area. More about Ben at partnerswithapurpose.org.
Next week on The Pulse, does this sound like a good time to you?
Basically, you're going to go inside this room. I'm going to lock the door. You have 1 hour to figure out how to escape.
Oh, the pressure, the drama. People are loving escape rooms, and we'll find out why faux fear is so much fun and what's happening inside of our brains as we're trying to get out. Subscribe to our podcast on iTunes and don't miss that episode of The Pulse. Bad old lady with those ugly, chunky stores.